Wednesday night edition of the pod. We've got our gamers to get to here, Cleveland and Boston. Boston shutting down the Cavaliers as they really struggled to convert from outside in that one. I just want to talk a little bit about what we saw from Isaiah Thomas in his return on Tuesday night. Also, we weren't planning on doing this game, but it turned into actually a really good one, Golden State and Dallas. And then going to look at New Orleans getting a big win in the playoff race at Utah, in addition to maybe a little bit more on some various games that we watched to some small degree. So why don't we start, Danny, in Boston, where it was a 102-88 win for the Celtics in rather comfortable fashion.
Yeah, I think the Celtics played well, and they definitely outplayed Cleveland in this game. And I'm immediately going to throw a little bit of a wet blanket on that by saying I didn't see anything in this one, especially with Isaiah being out, but either way, really, that made me think, like, I didn't see anything when I watched this and go, oh, that's going to be big in a 7-game series between these two teams that's played months from now. Boston played well. They deserve credit for that, but it didn't change the way I think about these two teams.
So you're going to say that 35 points from Terry Rozier and Marcus Smart combined on 7 of 12 3-point shooting is unlikely to recur?
Or Kevin Love shooting 1 for 11 from the field, including some after he sprained his ankle. I mean, Boston does deserve some credit. Jared Weiss and I had a discussion about this, and I would love for there people who have done research into this. With Boston's like the 3-point shooting against them, they've been really good this year. I think they've been good over the Stevens years, about whether there are some teams that kind of defy our maxim on it. But generally speaking, Cleveland isn't going to shoot 8 of 32 from 3. So Celtics, I mean, it's great that they played well, and especially that they got that from their bench, because they are going to need some of those guys in the playoffs. You know, starters play more minutes, but they'll need some good bench play, and they deserve credit for that. But there is a limitation to that in terms of transferability. The one big thing, and this was expected but still nice to see, was now that Marcus Morris is more the way back physically, that he started this game instead of Aaron Baines, even though Baines did some nice things in his 17 minutes.
Yeah, Baines also had a weird sprained ankle, although he was able to return, where he just like was running back on defense, stopped to kind of go up and guard a pick and roll, and then just sprained his ankle with nobody else around him. But you mentioned Morris, still been a struggle for him offensively. He was only 1 out of 6, but plus 16, all of the Celtics starters other than Horford were solid in the plus minus. And Morris, you know, many have said that he does one of the better jobs on LeBron James going back to his Detroit days. So much switching involved, though, that it's not necessarily just a one-man effort, because, you know, they're just going to switch basically any screen, even some pretty low resistance ones involving LeBron, unless Kyrie is involved. But Morris does give them another element. Jaylen Brown had missed time. He's back now. And they're able to get just more of those big switchable bodies. They also played Semi Ojeleye 23 minutes. And while I think really for me, though, this is a game where Boston played pretty well. They stopped the Cavs. Maybe they'll be able to hold them down a little bit better. The Cavs didn't even have a single 20-point score in this game. But, you know, I don't think that this team has enough firepower. I mean, even in this game, you know, they really were only slightly above a point per possession. And unless Kyrie Irving is going to really go off, which you would think that he would, it's surprising that he only had 11 points in this one. You know, I don't think that they can outscore Cleveland, because they're not going to hold Cleveland down 4 times in 7 games to this kind of an offensive performance, I don't think.
Along those lines, this one of the questions with the Cavs and the Warriors, especially because those teams just have such a long track record, and now especially the Cavs are an older team, it was interesting to me that this was not a game they got up for defensively. It seemed like that was more the Isaiah return game yesterday against Portland, where they had some moments where they played well defensively in this game, and it was LeBron in show mode a lot. Boston got 28 shots in the restricted area. They made 16 of those, and it wasn't all one guy, and, you know, Terry Rozier getting hot was largely independent of that. But I was surprised by that, because there were elements of it that you thought, oh, these two teams, you have the Kyrie element, you know, Cleveland just trying to assert it. I remember back when you and I were sitting in a hotel room in Portland last year in April, when the Cavs had one of those distinct non-show mode games where they really did bring it out right before the playoffs started. And I thought we would see more of that. I'm not like disappointed or anything like that. I'm just surprised.
Yeah, and they take a lot of it from LeBron. Love sprinting his ankle about half halfway through his stint, and then he eventually just, when he was down, they decided he was only going to play 20 minutes and he wouldn't return. He clearly was limping around. So yeah, I didn't think they had it defensively, but I mean, the bigger problem here for Cleveland is just they couldn't hit a shot in this one. They were 8 out of 32 on threes, and outside of Kyle Korver hitting four threes in a row during the second quarter, they were really cold. And then there were a further 3 out of 19 on mid-rangers, so that made them 11 out of 51 on jump shots. That's basically 20% on all jumpers. So this is a team that really relies on that. They were setting up usually some pretty good shots and just were not able to hit them. And once Boston took a 14-point lead in the third, you know, this wasn't one of those games where you felt like the tide coming back from Cleveland. You know, Jeff Van Gundy was noting just their general lack of energy on the boards and going after loose balls. So it was, clearly a game in which, you know, it didn't really matter that much to Cleveland. And I do think one thing that will help them when Isaiah is back is, like, he is a guy who really cares and who really, you know, despite his size limitations, plays really hard and plays with pace. And I think he, as you noted last night, is someone who can kind of inject them with some more energy as they really are kind of in the doldrums here.
And it makes sense also because he'll help get other guys clean looks depending on how they run a stagger with LeBron. And the Cavs are a team that their defense can be motivated by their offense. That happens a fair amount. Also, they defend less often in transition where they've ritually gotten killed. Not as much in this game. I mean, there were a couple of those moments, and Boston, as we've talked before, they were only credited with 9 fast break points. To me, they had more that were against the non-set defense. And I mean, Cleveland has so many culprits and that sort of a thing. I mean, Wade had a couple of possessions where he was complaining about calls. Love had one where he thought he got hacked, and I saw him gesticulating to the ref, and then I was just kind of started to counter in my head of like, when will I see him on the screen again? And I think it was about 4 full seconds.
And it was after Jason Tatum's 3 went through the rim is when you saw him.
Right.
And that was the 3. They had a nice run of shooting early in the third with Tatum. Jalen Brown hit a 3. And so they were, that's what put them up 14, that play you were talking about. And then, you know, it really never got below 10 after that point.
Well, and something also, you talked about how Korver was really the only guy on the Cavs who were hitting threes. One thing that surprised me was that the Celtics their main guys weren't doing it either. I mean, so their starting 5 was like 3 of 17 from 3. And most of those looks were pretty clean. A couple of them were contested, but not a ton. There was also a play that struck me, I think it was in the second quarter. This was not a good Jay Crowder game, really, on either end of the floor. But he had one play where
2 of 12, negative 15, 0 of 6 on threes for Crowder.
Where he was way behind, I believe it was Kyrie Irving, and Irving went up for a 3, and Jay Crowder got the kind of foul that bothers me more than almost any other one, where he wasn't there to contest the shot, but then still fouled the jump shooter because he got there late, he contested a little bit too hard and ran into him. And it was more of the leg contact, and he was all mad about that. But if you didn't affect the shot, don't get in there to try where it's close enough for you to draw a foul, because that's more, it's not necessarily fake hustle, it's just mistimed hustle sometimes. But those sorts of plays, like, it are even more devastating in a certain way when you're off defensively, just because, hey, they actually would have gotten a stop on that play, or that stop is a strong word, they would have not allowed any points, but because he was a little bit late and just ran into him, they got three foul shots. And I might not have been on him. I'm trying to remember who that was on, because Boston only took 11 free throws in this entire game.
Well, Crowder, more to the macro point, just the last couple of games, really just, you know, never been an explosive athlete, but really when he attacks the rim off of one foot, he really is just not getting up at all. He's getting blocked, missing a lot of layups around the rim, and he was not really, you know, sometimes depending on how he's playing, Lou will go back to him to close a half, but it did not do that in this game. I'll just give you a few random observations here, a lot of notes on this one. Daniel Tice was 5 of 26 on threes coming into the game and hit 2 in a row during the second quarter, including a pump fake sidestep 3. So that was interesting. That was he came in when Baines had sprained his ankle. I don't think he was necessarily part of the game plan as they were going smaller against this Cavs team. Channing Frye, again, didn't really play at all. They went with Tristan Thompson. He didn't do a ton in this game. Frye only played late and when it was out of hand. I thought that the Kyrie Irving pick and roll was something that Kyrie can get basically any shot he wants to in an isolation against Jose Calderon. And then also he was really the big impetus you know, with Calderon guarding Kyrie and then Kevin Love out on the floor trying to hedge against pick and rolls involving Kyrie with the starting unit for Cleveland, that it was really opening up a lot of stuff behind the play for Boston. That was really one of their more reliable offensive sets. And Kyrie, you know, still frustrating a little bit that, you know, when he's matched up against a Calderon, he's taking a step back three, you know, going to his right, fading away, which of course he can hit, but you would hope, hey, you know what, either get a great shot or get penetration, force them to double team, or make sure that you like shake him so badly that you're just absolutely wide open. So I that's always been troubling for me with Kyrie, because he's just too good to take such bad shots when he's being guarded by the likes of Calderon. And then on the other side, we didn't see too much of it. The Boston matchups were interesting, with Cleveland closing the first half with both Korver and Smith on the floor. They put Marcus Smart, the better defender, on Korver, who had been torching them, and they hid Kyrie on JR. And so Cleveland tried to get that pick and pop going with JR and LeBron, but then for some reason JR, like, he rolls to the basket on these plays, which is just, I don't know why he does that. He's not a roll threat. Like, how about you pop instead? But so they didn't really get much on those plays, but I expect that to be a staple late in games when these teams match up and it means something.
Yeah, and you talked about Kyrie settling for shots. That was something that we'll probably talk about later, because that was something I noted with Kevin Durant, who had a lot of favorable defensive matchups. But also, we talked about it briefly, but we should talk about Terry Rozier had that big run at the beginning, or sorry, the end of the first quarter. So he came in, and I think that's what really swung the game. So he had a three, and then he got a tip, and then he got another three. So that was, it was 8 points, really helped kind of swing the game, get the crowd enthusiastic. Boston ended that first quarter with an 11-point lead. And, you know, he's not going to have that game every single time, but he can do that a couple of times in a series, and it's a real big help to Boston.
Yeah, and he's been hitting the three ball a little bit better this year, you know, mid-30s, high-30s, which is beyond it, where he's been. And actually, you know, you mentioned the 8-point run in, you know, his three-minute stint. He actually, just in the last 30 seconds of quarters, scored 7 points in this game. And he brings the type of energy. I mean, I think if there's any way for Boston to really be competitive against Cleveland, it is just with their energy and their youth and getting loose balls and beating Cleveland down the floor and getting offensive rebounds from random guys like Smart and Rozier, and just having so much athleticism and length on the floor that Cleveland just cannot deal with it. And now when LeBron is more engaged, that is going to be less of a deficit for Cleveland. But it was an impressive game defensively. But again, much of it coming down to the fact that Love was not particularly engaged. They did not really get Love in the post very much at all. In fact, there's a period in the first quarter where Horford and Love just like took turns stopping each other in the post repeatedly. Horford trying to post up on Love didn't really work very well, although Horford eventually was relatively efficient in this one. So I think Cleveland, you know, they have a lot of other stuff that they can go to that's going to cause problems. And LeBron, he was awesome in the first half, 7 of 8 from the field, and then went 1 for his last 7 and ended up only playing 33 minutes as they kind of called off the dogs in the fourth quarter.
I was trying to think of a parallel for the idea you were talking about with the Celtics in a series with Cleveland, and I guess what it could be is sort of like what happened to the Spurs against OKC, when they just were out, the athleticism was a big problem, but the difference there was the OKC also had length. And, you know, Boston, it's not like they're like this bad. I mean, they're playing, oftentimes they're playing Jaylen Brown, and they have Marcus Smart, who plays above his height, obviously. But it's a little bit different with Cleveland. So I do think that that's the tact for it, and I think that's the way they're going to win a series. But it is interesting, because obviously there are ones in the earlier rounds where that sort of thing can happen, but when you think about a conference finals, that doesn't often tilt it, but it certainly can.
Few other notes here. Jason Tatum struggled to finish around the rim early. That's something that he, you know, if he gets a chance to dunk it, he'll look good. But on layups, not, you know, it sometimes he'll get the explosions. He's not great at dealing with the contact around the rim yet. I think that's something that will come for him. But he came on as the game went on. He just about broke Kyle Korver's ankles out of just a straight triple threat jab step where he drove in for a layup using the threat of his three ball he had a nice play in the third quarter as part of their run to break it open, where he crossed over, got to his right hand, and then threw a nice pass cross court to Al Horford for a left corner three. Jaylen Brown just has no idea how to guard LeBron James still. I mean, just he like tries to get his body on him and LeBron just spins off him, and he just doesn't know what he's doing. He has no leverage, doesn't understand how to use his body, at least didn't commit any fouls. They did not go with Jaylen really hardly at all as the primary defender on LeBron. But on the few times they got matched up on switches, LeBron just dominated him. What else do you have on this one? Anything?
I think that's about it.
Okay, well, let's do a quick read and then we can discuss Isaiah Thomas's game from last night and get to the rest of the show. One New Year's resolution, people are always like, oh, I'm going to get a gym membership, I'm going to work out more. You can also just, have a resolution to be a little bit more comfortable this year and do that with a MeUndies membership. You can get fresh new underwear or socks delivered to your door with bold, classic, or adventurous prints. And what I like about them is just they fit perfectly. It's made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. The most comfortable pair of underwear that I have owned. Always the first underwear when the laundry is done that I will use. And we also know that underwear just regularly wears out. So that's why this membership plan, which will save you a bunch of money, is the way to go with MeUndies. They have an exclusive offer just for Dunktown listeners until January 20th. You can get 20% off your membership and free shipping. That's 20% off an already discounted membership. They are so sure you will love their underwear, they offer a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you order a pair and you don't love your first pair, you will get a full refund. So become a member today for the best membership you'll ever sign up for. MeUndies.com/capspace is that URL. That's MeUndies.com/capspace. Become a member today and start enjoying all the perks of a MeUndies membership and start wearing the best underwear of your life. That's MeUndies.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us with that /capspace URL. So Isaiah was outstanding last night, I thought, given the amount of rust that he had. Ended up with 17 points. I misspoke earlier, in 19 minutes, 6 of 12, shooting, 3 assists. And how did he look to you just physically, Danny?
Better than I expected. So he was coming off that torn labrum in his hip, and my expectation was that they were going to have it at a point where he was stable, but that he just wasn't all the way back physically. And certainly, you know, his burst wasn't 100%. But he was able to generate separation. He was able to reasonably stick with the players he was guarding, and he had some reasonably tough assignments. They did have him largely, it was a mix, but he came off the bench and he played a mix with the starters and not with the starters.
Yeah, he was guarding Connaughton a lot. I mean, they right. definitely weren't like, hey, go guard Damian Lillard, though. You know, that it was something that he did to some degree. And one thing that is a little bit different about him and Kyrie is Isaiah will at least try to fight over a screen. You know, I mean, like there was one time he was guarding Lillard and Lillard got a screen and went for the three, but Isaiah at least was like, you know, kind of on his hip a little bit, you know, which is more than Irving has been better in Boston, still has his issues. But, you know, if you compare Irving Cleveland to Isaiah, at least that's something that Isaiah will give you. So you can at least hope to play conventional pick and roll defense with him a reasonable amount of the time and that he'll fight over. You know, that's not where the big weakness is. It's more he's just so short as a help defender. And then, you know, if he gets down in the post, but pick and roll defense, he's not awful.
There was that play where he got caught under the rim. I think it was Aminu was there, and he just
Ed Davis didn't even
notice he was there, basically. And Isaiah, depending on how they use him, could be a real godsend for Tristan Thompson, just because he's good at finding big guys in those circumstances. And I like that they played him also with Jay Crowder, one of the guys that he's familiar with. And there were a couple plays where he passed Jay Crowder open, which is exactly what you want a point guard to do. And so, yeah, I thought the stat line is nice, but for me, when you're watching a game like this, I'm never vary from the idea that it's more about watching them physically, how they move, how comfortable they are, rather than that. Because if he a couple of those shots hadn't gone in, it wouldn't affect the most important part of this game. And so I thought that was, he had both parts of it working there, and that's good. I mean, Cleveland does not need Max Isaiah Thomas to, they're not pushing like, oh my god, if we don't get the one seed, everything's falling apart. But the closer he is now, the closer they can expect him to be in April, May, and June when this really matters.
Yeah, and we saw, you know, he did like his little Smitty move. I thought one play that was real nice was like he was driving down the right side of the lane. Ed Davis kind of thought he had him contained, and then he jump stopped immediately to his left and was able to create a passing angle to Dwayne Wade, who got fouled on a layup. Wade actually was awesome in that game too, with his cutting along the baseline, which Isaiah had a nice chemistry with him already, I thought, as well. But the 8 3-point attempts was good. I mean, the three ball looked good for him. A lot lot of times when guys come off of a layoff, I mean, and I thought just the aggressiveness that he showed, you know, Dylan Murphy had a good point on Twitter saying that for Isaiah, he's one of those guys who can come in next to LeBron James and have enough confidence to kind of play his game. But the good news is that Isaiah is actually efficient when playing his game, unlike, you know, say like a Jamal Crawford type of guy who's less efficient and still takes shots out of the hands of your best players. So I thought, you know, his movement was good, his off-ball movement was good, and he provides a pace that this Cavaliers team can use on offense, where, you know, and it's not even necessarily pace and like running it down people's throat, but just quick movement, quick decisions, coming off the screen, moving the ball quickly. You know, I think that's something that he learned, especially in Boston, and that he can add to this Cavs squad.
Cleveland already could put together some really fun offensive lineups with LeBron and a bunch of shooting around him, but if you think about either replacing LeBron with Isaiah in some of those lineups and going with different guys, or just using both of those guys together, Cleveland can just, they can throw some lineups out there that no team can really defend that well. And I'm excited to see how they use Isaiah and Kyle Korver together, you know, two guys that have been in it, that have competed against each other kind of in some different settings, but they've never been teammates. And I'm excited to see how all of these combinations work. I always like that with point guards when they get into new circumstances, and we're going to have plenty of time to evaluate it, hopefully, between now and the rest of the regular season.
So let's get to Utah and New Orleans now. This is a big game, and Utah coming in was 16-21, but you know, it was pretty similar playoff odds to the Pels. Utah would have been favored in this game, and the Pels winning this one on the road was big. They upped their playoff chances just with this by about 10%, I think, and lowered Utah's by about 10% based on those 538 odds. So this is one of those ones that we may go back to and say, yeah, you know, they lost it, and they won pretty handily at Utah. It was a 108-98 Pels win, led by AD, who had 29 points in 41 minutes. Actually, he had to play a little bit more because DeMarcus Cousins was in ridiculous foul trouble again. But the big story here was Utah just not being able to hit a shot outside of the restricted area.
Yeah, I mean, they had a lot of trouble as jump shooters. I mean, they were 7-32 from three, and Donovan Mitchell, you know, still having a wonderful, wonderful season, and still put up 24 points on 17 field goal attempts because he had another five shooting possessions from the line when he was 9 of 10. Rubio struggled from the field and was negative 20. I didn't realize it was that bad. I knew he struggled. I didn't realize it was that bad. Negative 20 in 24 minutes. And so they weren't really getting that part of their offensive foundation. And so you go, oh, you know, sometimes if Rubio, Mitchell are cold, Rodney Hood can really deliver, but he didn't have a great offensive game either. So they didn't.
No, he had an awful, was 1 of 11. So he was miserable in this one.
So they didn't really have that kind of foundational offense that can be important for them. But one area that they did succeed in a little bit, which should be troubling to Pelicans partisans, is that Utah is not the greatest running team. They've been better, to my eyes, this year than in previous years, partially because they have significantly better personnel. They've been playing one big most of the time. They have Ricky Rubio, and Mitchell can push it a little bit. But New Orleans has been pretty bad in transition this year. We talked about it in the 15 and 60. And Utah was able to run on them more than I expected they would.
Yeah, it's really the only way that they're able to be effective was running. And they got the Pels had a bunch of turnovers in this game too, which did not help them at all. That was really the one place where they were not effective offensively. I think the biggest takeaway for this one for me was a couple of things. Number one was that Rondo again did not close this game. His role was minimized. I think he got the Keith Bogans in both halves, and actually it was effective from a box score standpoint. He was 5 of 9 and had 12 points, was very much dominating the ball, especially at the start of the third quarter. But yeah, got the Keith Bogans started, but never came back in the game at being subbed out. And I think part of the reason for that was that the Jazz were closing with Donovan Mitchell at point guard in these halves, not playing Rubio. And so the feeling is, I think Gentry is starting to realize like how bad Rondo is defensively most of the time, you know, just the lack of effort that he has. And he got, as much as he was scoring, he was getting smoked by Rubio at the start of the third quarter as well. Just like a straight line one-on-one drive, he got beat, and then Rubio just easily went back door on him as well on a play where, you know, he went back door on a DHO, where it's like, are you really that scared of Rick Rubio coming off a DHO? He's not going to shoot that ball. But so they felt like, hey, you know, this is my guess, but they said, hey, you know, we can't have Rondo trying to guard Donovan Mitchell or Rodney Hood, so instead we're going to go a little bit bigger. And they went with a lineup that I think actually might be their best unit, which is Holiday, who was awesome awesome in this game. We'll get to that. Etuan Moore, who was not awesome with 6 turnovers, but still can shoot the ball and is a solid defender. And then Darius Miller at the 3, along with Cousins and Davis. But amazingly, that unit has barely played together this season.
I knew I hadn't seen much of them, because that lineup makes intuitive sense. Like, basically, the idea behind it is you have a shooter with all these other guys, and he's the shooter they have that has the most reliable one that has size. You know, like,
here's some sense to it. You have a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, and a 5 on the court.
Yeah, that's true.
They basically don't have with any of their other lineup.
So I knew I hadn't seen it much, and that's what led, and you're talking about it, led me to want to look it up. And I was shocked that it was even more pronounced than I had expected. So they had played 11 minutes together before tonight's game. That was 22 possessions, according to Clean the Glass, 11 minutes, I think, on both CTG and on stats on NBA. And they played 15 minutes together after tonight. Positive, I mean, in this game, positive overall. And what is more jarring than that is that it is, so there are 5 different variants that the Pelicans have used with Drew Holiday, Etuan Moore, Anthony Davis, and DeMarcus Cousins. They've used Rondo, of course, that's been most used. They've used Dante Cunningham there. They've used Ian Clark. And to have Miller be the least used of those is strange, because he's the one, I mean, you could argue Cunningham if they think he's a 3, but those are the guys that make the most sense with the other personnel, because using Ian Clark, I think they've done like 80 something minutes with that. I think some of that was based on injuries and other things earlier in the season, but that's putting Ian Clark in a pretty rough position. So I'm encouraged that Gentry went to that when the going gets rough. And then the other part of what Gentry chose to do was, it wasn't that he went away from using a second point guard sized guy with Drew Holiday. It was that he went to Jameer Nelson instead. Jameer Nelson came in late in the third quarter and played until they replaced him with Etuan Moore late in the fourth. I think it was about 3.5 minutes to go.
Yeah, so this will be interesting to monitor. I mean, I think maybe they'll probably continue to start Rondo, and it wouldn't surprise me even if Rondo was enticed to sign there by promises of him starting. You know, he's on that 1-year, $4 million deal, but you know, not like he had some other great offers to entice him. But nonetheless, you would imagine that those were the discussions that were had, something along those lines. The Pels, who is going to be their fifth guy? You know, I think Moore, Holiday, Cousins, and Davis are obviously guys who are going to be in there probably no matter what at this point at the end of games. The other thing that I thought is just DeMarcus, again, just an absolutely asinine foul to get his fourth foul and take himself out of the game. And that was probably actually good for the Pels, because AD, at least in this game, because AD played more and they didn't really have like Cousins by himself with no AD time, which is where they've really gotten killed this year. So on this play, DeMarcus was switched on to Joe Johnson, who was playing at the 4. Joe does the same move that he's done 8 billion times and kind of gets a slight shoulder past Cousins and then, you know, puts his shoulder into him to kind of, you know, knock him off and create space for the jumper. And Cousins, you know, I mean, this is a play that happens, you know, 8 million times a game, took exception to that. You know, I mean, Joe Johnson is like 255, but DeMarcus is probably, you know, like 280 or something. And then, you know, with already 3 fouls, it's early in the third quarter, just decides that because he was mad that Joe did that, and because Joe, no foul was called on him, that DeMarcus just basically like fouls him in retaliation, giving up free throws and also just taking himself out of the game. Like, he just completely lost his composure. What is fouling him back at that time gonna do? I mean, at the very least, if you feel like it was a cheap shot, just like wait and get his ass later. You know, like, I mean, if you're just gonna like grab him, like, you accomplished nothing at all. Like, you foul him so then you can like start yelling at him. And then the best part of it is DeMarcus goes to the bench and he's like screaming at the refs, call the fucking foul, call the fucking foul. Like, you could hear it through the TV. And, you know, he didn't get teed up, but it's like, you know, for DeMarcus, when he gets his tees, I mean, you know, that's the kind of stuff that he doesn't get teed up for, you know? I mean, like, that's, and he's just screaming it from the bench so loud that the microphones can hear it. And just for him, the way he plays defensively, and, you know, he's having a wonderful offensive season. You know, he's probably going to make an All-NBA team for me when we do our award show tomorrow. But still, I just question how far you can go with someone with that type of an attitude and that kind of type of inconsistency, and just everyone on the team knowing, hey, you know what, we can't rely on this guy on a game-to-game basis.
I was thinking about it in the context of, first of all, playing on a bigger stage, which he's going to do in all likelihood this year than he has before, but also the idea of committing to him. So next year, you know, moving forward, he's going to sign a big contract with somebody. We don't know who it's going to be, but that's going to be his 28, 29, 30, 31 season, something in that range. And so how does that affect him physically? And
most guys figure it out by 27.
Exactly. And that's what I was getting at. I was like, so what are you committing to with him? You're obviously, he's insanely talented. Like, he's physically one of the most talented guys for his size we've seen in a long time. There happen to be a bunch of other physically talented guys around his size that are coming in right now, but they're a lot younger and he's more fully formed than they are. But he doesn't have that element where you go, I'm an important player on a team that has real aspirations now. I can't pull this stuff anymore. You know, even if I'm mad, sometimes you just have to let it roll past you. And I've criticized other players for their lack of awareness in terms of like fouls and situation, and that they commit fouls because they're that are unbefitting their role. DeMarcus Cousins is at a whole different level because I don't even have those expectations for him. I just, you know, he's just going to be DeMarcus.
Yeah. And, you know, just even when it's just like frustration and mental mistakes and not getting back on defense because he's pissed off, or just, you know, losing focus for a couple of possessions because something happened with the refs. It's just, you know, and by all accounts, he is like a nice guy in the community and stuff like that, but it just cannot compose himself on the court. And that is taking away from the fact that this is a nice Pelicans win. And the other thing that I thought was very interesting, as we saw Utah, you mentioned going with basically, you know, one true big. They put Jarebko in, and then also, I don't think Cephalosha played in this one.
He did not.
No, yeah, he was not available, and I think they missed him a fair amount defensively. But with Joe Johnson, with Jarebko, AD, for one of the first times this year, really got on the offensive glass. He, and I like the formula for the Pels. I mean, they shot it extremely well in this game, but they had 7 offensive rebounds. All 7 of those were by AD and Cousins, and AD had 4, Cousins had 3, AD got another one on a loose ball foul, and the offensive rebounding was enormous because they scored 2.17 points for every offensive rebound that they got in this game. Wow. So with and ones, with threes that they got off of that, they were so insanely efficient. And when AD and Cousins are the guys getting those rebounds, they're right under the basket. They're huge. They can just go right back up for the putback in very efficient fashion. They're not going to kind of Dennis Rodman it, where they just, you know, they get the offensive rebound and they're going to throw it out. You know, they're not going to Reggie Evans or Danny Fortson in it. So that was really useful, and I still hope to see more of that from the Pels, which, you know, does seem somewhat counter to Gentry's philosophy. Last thing on the Pels before we talk a little bit about the Jazz, Drew Holiday looked very athletic in this one. You know, he had a missed dunk, but, you know, kind of went in, and it was one of those ones where you're like, oh, this is a half court. Like, you're kind of surprised that he went for the dunk. He missed it, but he went up with two hands off of 1 foot. He had another nice drive where he rejected a screen and went in for a nice double pump or reverse. So he looked bouncier than we're accustomed to seeing from him, and it did most of his damage on two-pointers. You know, usually he's been hot from on jump shots, but was 10 out of 16 on this one, 8 of 11 on two-pointers for his 24 points.
One other thing I wanted to mention from the Pelicans' perspective is that they didn't attempt their first free throws in this game until about 3.5 minutes left in the third quarter. And
yes, Joel Myers and David Wesley were having a little bit of fun with that.
They were, and they didn't. Then they got a lot in the fourth. They ended up getting 10 free throws in the fourth, and it was an important part of their push at that point, and just kind of, you know, holding on and keeping all of it. But because they had 27 points in the fourth quarter, and I think yes, 10 of those, I think, or something like that, came from the line.
Yeah, that was amusing. Although Utah is not a high foul team, and in part of it was that they just, you know, weren't playing great defense in this one. For Utah, Ricky Rubio they're bringing him in early with the idea that they're going to close with Mitchell at the point. They're bringing him in early in the fourth and second quarters, and then, you know, taking him out with about 6 minutes to go. And that, however, leaves him in the game at the same time as Epe Udo. And with those two guys in a pick and roll combination, really is just, you're not getting anything. And with that being the primary impetus of the Jazz offense, especially late in the third, early in the fourth, they really just were totally grinding their gears when Donovan Mitchell was out of the game. And so that's going to be something to watch as well. And I think when Rudy Gobert comes back and then you've got Favors and Rubio together, I think you're going to be much better off as a pick and roll combo there, because Favors is a guy who can catch the ball at the free throw line and make some plays, which Udo is just not going to do. And then especially you throw in as well Anthony Davis at center. I mean, he doesn't look like he's trying that hard out there, but every pick and roll they ran against him when he was the five and he was playing conventional pick and roll defense just went absolutely nowhere. I mean, he's just swallowing it up in conventional pick and roll defense. It was very effective there. The big run came with AD at center and with Udo and Rubio out there. They tried to go to Joe Johnson a fair amount, and he was on fire. He had a season high 20 points, but wasn't effective during that particular stretch. And the Pels hit a couple of threes. Joe is really bad defensively at this point. Like he overhelped on an Ian Clark drive and then just gave up a wide open corner three to Dante Cunningham. Then AD got a pick and pop three. That was huge. So all in the last minute of the third quarter to push it from a 3-point lead to a 9-point lead. And the Jazz never really were able to get back in contact after that point.
And it gets into something that I just want to see more of. Utah's offense has been better than I anticipated this year, partially just because Donovan Mitchell has really come on and he's been better than I thought. But there are going to be times when they're going to have to come back from behind, and it's going to rely on a real team effort for them. And I certainly believe they can do it, but they're going to have to do that probably more often in the second half of the season. And we're going to, and that might end up determining whether they make the playoffs or not.
Yeah. And Rodney Hood, we mentioned he was actually 1 of 10, not 1 for 11, but 0 of 6 on threes. And he's the guy who I think if you're going to go with those lineups, presumably with him, Rubio, Udo out there, and Joe Johnson, you should be able to get enough. But Hood is not really a matchup guy who can just beat his man. And so he gets a lot of threes off with that great rise on his jumper, very versatile jumper. But if his three-pointer is not falling, he really doesn't have another way to be efficient, because he's never going to get to the foul line, never going to get all the way to the rim. And so he's very reliant on that jump shot. And that's David Locke pointed this out, that he's had a bunch of games where he's shot below 33%, and that the Jazz have a very poor record in those games. But if you're exclusively reliant on jump shots, you're going to have more variance in your game to some degree.
Is there anything else you have on this game, or do you want to move on to one of the other ones? This was a pretty eventful night.
Yeah, and that is a great tease for this Warriors-Dallas game and some of the other ones we want to get to. But first, this from the toothbrush that I use, Quip Toothbrush. My sister was in town over Christmas, so I was able to remind her that I used her term sweater teeth in the ads for Quip Toothbrush. And if you've never used an electric toothbrush before, you can start brushing better today, and you can avoid sweater teeth. That's when your teeth kind of have this coating of plaque on them, and you can feel it with your tongue, and it feels like your teeth are wearing a sweater. It's awful. So don't get sweater teeth. Get Quip toothbrushes. They start at just $25. So I mean, you're going to get much cleaner and get clean much more easily using an electric toothbrush. And then Quip is by far the best of the electric toothbrushes. They start at just $25. It's basically the size of a normal size toothbrush, as opposed to the bigger ones that, you know, you probably can't really travel with very well unless you just have like this huge dop kit. The Quip, I just throw it in my bag. And the other thing is, you don't have to charge it. It just runs on a AAA battery for 3 months. And then all of the things that you just kind of do wrong, and I used to do wrong about brushing your teeth because you're lazy, Quip Toothbrush like stops you from doing that, right? You can subscribe to a 3-month plan and get a new brush head, you know, where you just see like some of the toothbrushes that people have where they just are like, you know, I don't really want to get a new toothbrush. They'll just ship you the new brush head right to your door. It's got a timer on it for 2 minutes. So you actually will brush the amount of time that you're supposed to. And then it's like will blip every 30 seconds so you can know to go on to a different quadrant of your mouth. So check this thing out. The way to do it is getquip.com/capspace. That URL, getquip.com/capspace. Easy to remember. We talk about capspace all the time on the program. That'll get you your first refill pack for free when you get that Quip electric toothbrush that starts at just $25. And they've got some features to sexy it up if you want to spend a little bit more than that as well. But for $25, it's a great gift as well. You can just get one for you and your significant other for $50 out the door if you want to. And once you have it, you'll be in awe that you ever use something else. Getquip.com/capspace is that URL. Again, we get tons of great feedback on Twitter. And if you try one of these and you like it, hit me up on Twitter. We like to send them those positive feedback as well to keep them on the program. So getquip.com/capspace, again, is that URL. Check it out. So yeah, this is a game, you know, we do so many Warriors games, so we weren't planning on doing this one. But because it was such a classic finish, I thought that we should check it out. It was a 125-122 Warriors win. Steph Curry with a three-pointer on a no timeout after Harrison Barnes tied the game. What were your overall impressions here?
This was not the greatest defensive performance from the Warriors, who have been really engaged before Steph Curry came back, and they weren't good defensively at all against Memphis either. So that's, you file it away a little bit. I don't think it's a big deal. But also, Dallas deserves immense credit for making it a good offensive night for themselves. They were hitting open threes. They were 19 of 43 from distance. And one of their real bread and butter things, especially in that second quarter, was the JJ Barea, Dwight Powell pick and roll. And they were lighting up the Warriors. Powell had a career night, tied his career high with 21 points, 7-9 from the field, 2-2 from three, got to the line a bunch, got a series of offensive rebounds, including one possession where I think he got two or three himself. And so they were able to get those looks. And even so, I thought Dallas, it's hard to say they outplayed the Warriors, but I thought they did a really nice job. They were still down 10 with, I think it was 2.5 or 3.5 minutes left. And then in rapid fire, the Warriors basically just let them back in the game. Couple of turnovers, one crazy one off a Kevin Durant block. Then Yogi Ferrell actually could have put Dallas ahead, missed that shot. But then I think they went ahead anyway, but it was on the next possession. So I think it was a fun game in that way, where you got a good shot from Dallas and kind of a shaky one from the Warriors. And because a lot of guys had good nights.
Yeah, you mentioned Dwight Powell, and I thought that Dallas was doing a couple of nice things with him, utilizing his quickness, being as at center, being guarded by David West in conventional pick and roll defense a lot of the time. And what they would do is, rather than a pick and roll just where the guy's dribbling and you kind of trot up and you can weak it or you can ice it, you know, force the ball away from the screen or force him to go a certain way, what they'll do is they'll have Powell sprint up to the top of the key, throw him the ball right as he is arriving there, and then Barea, who is a great stop and start athlete, really smart guy, those guys had a nice chemistry as you mentioned, he'll cut off of Powell to get the DHO. And a lot of times even Powell will throw it before Barea even has gotten to the point where it would be a straight up handoff on a screen. Like, he'll catch it and then just throw it right back to Barea as Barea has started cutting towards the rim, and then Powell will slip back to the basket again, and that really catches the big guarding him in trouble. They don't know whether to switch it, and then the big is not going to be as fast as Powell, so he's moving up. All of a sudden, Powell passes the ball back, then releases towards the basket, and he was able to get some alley-oops there. They were able to get Barea to turn the corner on those plays a lot, and it was really just a nice, very simple action that I think more teams could use, especially if you have a mobile big against maybe a slower one. So they really caused problems for the Warriors there, and then the Warriors were doing a ton of your low-resistance switches as well, and that was leading to problems with the Barea again matched up against West, and so it was not the best Warrior defensive performance by any means, helped by the fact that the Mavs were on fire from three, 19 out of 43.
Wes Matthews and Kevin Durant have been close in the career made threes, which is something I keep an eye on. And Wes blew past Durant actually in this game, because I think Durant was two ahead of him, and he was 7-1 in this game. Matthews was confident. He was hitting a bunch of shots. I mean, everybody really for them was taking him. Devin Harris jacked up five. I think he hit his first one, and so it was one of those circumstances where it's like you want a guy to hit his first shot. And Dallas has had great success this year with the lineup that Kerr called the Energizer Bunnies. Tim McMahon is thinking about adopting that, which is Barea, Devin Harris, and Yogi Ferrell all together. That trio didn't do particularly great in this game, but that kind of makes sense because the Warriors can handle a lot of the stuff they throw at it. But then the big exception to that was, I don't think that, I have to run off the top of my head, that the Dwight Powell, Barea stuff wasn't all with that lineup out there. But then that ties in with, to me, what was the other striking element of this game. Kevin Durant had 25 points on 23 shooting possessions. And so, you know, that's better than most players. But he had the advantage matchup almost every time he had the ball and settled way too often. It felt to me like if he had engaged a little bit more, driven harder, drawn some fouls, that this game could have been over in the third quarter and the Warriors are going to be on a back-to-back. We're covering the Houston game for the Twitter NBA show. And so he is so good that you change the expectations, and he didn't meet those offensive expectations in this game.
Yeah, it was interesting, and he had a good interview that I recommend, and a podcast as well with Anthony Slater, in which he talked a little bit about, you know, changing his game to go to the mid-range more, that driving to the basket is something that is fatiguing, especially I think at this point in his career in the regular season. You know, he is content, and he was very to just shoot over guys, and he was very good in the first half as he scored 16 points on 10 shots, but then dropped off. Still, you know, a reasonably efficient night with 25 points on 23 shooting possessions. But you're right, given the fact that he was so often on switches matched up against a Yogi Ferrell, who actually is a stouter post defender, you might think he's been getting some lessons from JJ Barea on that, I think, but not as much flopping. He actually goes for being a little bit stronger. I thought he could have done better there. Steph Curry continues to look awesome in his return. We'll get to the end of the game, but 32 points and 8 assists for him. 6 out of 13 from 3. He had spoken to Marcus Thompson about how when he was injured, he was only shooting 38% from 3, and he was checking on Basketball Reference his stats and obsessing that he was under 40%, and then by going 10 out of 13 in his first game back, he was over 40%, and then he's continued to improve that. I thought for Dallas, Dallas, you know, Dennis Smith had an interesting game. He was the one Mav really who shot poorly. He was 6 out of 18, had 14.0 free throw attempts. But, you know, I didn't think his shot selection was terrible. I think he just, you know, they were giving him the shot. They're going over, going under on him. And most of the jumpers that he took were kind of wide open shots that you need to take. It just, you know, they didn't go in for him. And he's not that great of a jump shooter. He's going to have shooting nights like that.
He also had one play that was striking just because it doesn't happen very often, where he effectively changed speeds on Draymond Green, driving to his right, and then got past Green and got a layup before he recovered. And that just doesn't happen often. And
he was blowing by some of these switch defenders in this game, including that dunk that he had on Jordan Bell.
Oh, yeah.
Where Bell couldn't even get off the ground. Like, he was guarding him on a switch. Smith, one dribble to his left, and then takes off almost from the dotted line. It goes up for a two-handed dunk off of 2 feet before Bell could even jump. It was just, like, you could tell Bell was just shocked that, like, he got up that quickly.
And you see those moments from Smith, and you go, okay, we'll give him time to figure the rest of this stuff out. He also needs to care more on defense. But that wasn't really what decided this game, and I think that's as good a transition as we're going to have into.
Well, one more thing on Smith, too. I thought his passing looked pretty good in this one. I mean, he had a couple of drives where he could have passed out, but 8 assists in 29 minutes, and I thought he was pretty useful. I mean, because his assists are generally leading to, like, threes or layups, and so he was, I thought he showed good patience and didn't take that many bad shots. You know, when he got into trouble, he was able to pass out of it most of the time.
In his first three shots, the one he made was the worst one. It was when he shot at, like, a 30 footer and made that one, yeah. And then missed the other two that were pretty open.
Okay, but yeah, you're going to transition towards the end of the game here.
Yeah, so I mean, I mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating that the Warriors were up 10 with about 2 minutes to go. And so you're kind of settling in. They still have their, it wasn't the Hamptons five. You still refuse to use that because Iguodala did not play in this game.
Yeah.
So they originally were using Jordan Bell, and then they ended up switching to Patrick McCaw. And the Mavs deserve credit for continuing to fight, but the Warriors just made some pretty just sloppy mistakes in that end push.
Yeah, I mean, the Warriors led by 10 after a Steph Curry layup, 120 to 110. And then after a Wes Matthews missed three, the rebound went right back to him. Not a ton of hustle there from the Warriors. And that led to Yogi Ferrell making a corner three. And then the turnovers began. And that really, I mean, you know, turnovers and three shot fouls, right? Are those always the keys to these comebacks? And so Draymond Green pushed off on an inbounds pretty blatantly and got an offensive foul. Then we saw those two crazy turnovers you talked about and that Kevin Durant settle that you talked about as well. Meanwhile, Harrison Barnes got to the foul line for a couple, and then Wes Matthews made a three after KD blocked Yogi Ferrell and got a defensive rebound, and then Dwight Powell stole it from him and got it to Matthews. And then Draymond Green inbounded it. Yogi Ferrell stole it again, went to the right corner, and barely missed a three that actually could have given Dallas the lead. And so they're right back in it at that point with those eight straight points. Without the Warriors, they had three turnovers and, you know, one missed contested 21-footer during that period.
And so then Dallas ends up getting the ball back, and Harrison Barnes goes to he off of a Smith drive, he goes to a mid-ranger, a shot that both the fan bases in watching this game were very familiar with, and and then that was the one where he got fouled, right?
No,
that was the one where he just shot a mid-ranger. He shot it from the free throw line. That's right.
Yeah. Smith had a nice drive, got double teamed, picked up his dribble, and he threw like this long looping pass that, you know, it could have been an open three. And that's, we talked about that in the 15 and 60, that Smith's kind of passing accuracy and speed. He'll see the pass, but it doesn't quite get there. But it still gave Barnes enough of an advantage to elude Steph Curry and hit a jumper to tie it. And then the Warriors went for a timeout. I liked the timeout with 39 seconds remaining because that's when you want to set up the 2-for-1. And so they ran their cyclone play, which we also talked about in the 15 and 60, where Steph Curry will set a back screen for a power forward. It was Draymond Green in this case, but Dallas was ready for it. They switched it, and then off of that, they got Draymond in the post, and Wes Matthews just, there wasn't even a screen. Klay Thompson just, like, Wes was trying to pressure him up because he brought the ball up court, and Klay just went back door on him and made this kind of lucky twisting layup to put the Warriors up two. And then Carlisle went with what was a fateful timeout in a couple of ways. Number one, he put in Dirk Nowitzki for Dwight Powell to space the floor. And then I loved the design of the play. They went to Patrick McCaw, who was still in. They had KD guarding Durant, but then they ran a screen to get the switch KD onto whoever it was with the entry. And then they threw it to Barnes, guarded by McCaw at the free throw line, that old Dirk office hours. And Barnes was able to just go right through McCaw for a a spin move and a layup, and the Warriors couldn't bring help because there was so much shooting on the floor, and I think they were concerned about giving up a three, which I probably would have been too in that situation. So they're really, you know, KD was kind of there, but he also was switched on to Yogi Ferrell, so he couldn't guard, you know, couldn't come too hard because Ferrell was standing there in the corner. And then the Warriors went to the no timeout, which was a fantastic idea with Dirk Nowitzki on the floor.
It was absolutely the right call. It was about 10 seconds to go, which, so I was going to ask you about this at the time, because you weren't watching it live and I was. My thought has been, because the Warriors took too long and didn't get the 2-for-1. So Dallas got the ball with about 24 seconds left. And so for me, you can kind of go in two tracks. One of them is you can go late and go with the three, because that way it's like you're basically playing for the last shot.
You go right away. Jim Barnett was agreeing with you, but I think the math is in your favor there. You got to go right away because you give yourself time for an offensive rebound. I mean, when you're down, you need to give yourself
as many chances as you can.
Yeah, I think so. You got to just like say, hey, you know what? Like, we got to give ourselves more chances, whether it's an offensive rebound, because you also have the ability to send all of your guys to the offensive glass, which more teams really should do when they are down. Like, everybody should be sprinting to the offensive glass when you're down in the last minute and missing or with the shot clock off like that. And then you also can still foul. You could try to get a steal on the inbound, hope that they miss one shot. You can come down and try and hit a three.
I agree with you on substance, but I think for two reasons the Warriors might be a little bit unusual in terms of this. One is they are a very potent offense, and so if you're going for a two, your best case scenario is that you're giving the Warriors the opportunity to take the last shot, and so that's one issue. And then the second one is if you want to get into a free throw battle, they're probably, in terms of the guys that you can get in those late situations, unless they screw up the inbound, which they have in the past, that they have guys who can make those shots. So if that's the way you're going to go with it, I think you're right in like 95% of the circumstances, but I think this might be in that 5%.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, you could also make the point that, you know, if you're going to go with Dirk Nowitzki, who's just so easily attackable by a Steph Curry, that maybe you do want to try to run the time down. But I guess you're also, I mean, the idea too, like, of like, oh, we run the time down and we're going to go for a three. I mean, you run the possibility too that you just like, I mean, I think the bigger thing too is just that like, you want to give yourself the best possible chance to score that bucket whenever it occurs, right? If you end up running the whole 24 seconds off, running your offense, moving the ball around, that's fine. But if you're like, okay, we're going to intentionally run the time down, now you're reducing your chances of making that first bucket to the point where I think you're in trouble. So no, I think you got to just, you're down, you got to tie the game any way you can, do it as fast as possible, go fast, give yourself multiple chances at it. And because you're basically not only looking at it as like, okay, you know, one shot, but it's like time as well. The more time that you have, you know, if you only have 10 seconds, you just can't go through as many options. So you got to look at it as like you're going through all of the options in your playbook, you're moving the ball, you know, you don't have like that sixth defender, which is, you know, the end of the game clock there causing problems for you.
Well, yeah, if you're going for a two, absolutely, you go as quickly as possible. The idea for a three is basically the all or nothing proposition. And so
now you can go for the three and then use the threat of that to get the two. And that's in fact kind of what they did here.
Yeah, that is what they did here.
Of the spacing, I mean, it wasn't directly a play for a three, but it was.
Yeah, it was a possibility, and it was a possibility that scared the Warriors enough that they didn't concede the two, but they didn't make it as hard as they could have because they didn't want the three. So what that led to was 10 seconds left. Curry brings it up a little more slowly than I expected, but I think that's because they saw exactly what they wanted to do the whole way. Draymond set a high screen because
it was interesting. Actually, Dennis Smith was on Curry, and you could see him telling Yogi Ferrell, "No, you go guard him. You go guard him." which was funny. So Ferrell went out there. I guess Dennis realized that he was not as good of a defender as Yogi Ferrell, I guess, which was some decent humility, I suppose, from Dennis. Maybe he could also just like try to be a better defender, but you know, he's got better tools than Yogi does. But you know, I guess he realized that Carlisle would have wanted Yogi on Steph.
And Dirk got out there for a late contest, but I don't think Steph really felt it that much. Took the three.
Oh, not at all.
Took the three, made it with 3 seconds left, and Dallas didn't have a timeout left, and that was all she wrote.
Yeah, and this always kills me too, like when you have 3 seconds left, just like, I know you have a small chance of actually completing the pass, but like throw the inbounds pass to midcourt if you have no timeouts left, because if you inbound it anywhere short of midcourt, like there's just not gonna be enough time to get any kind of a real shot, so you might as well just throw it there. It's probably gonna get picked off, it's probably not gonna be complete, but you're completely dead in the water if you don't do that to begin with. So it's one of these like, oh, we're gonna stay in the game for for another 3 seconds instead of turning it over. But if you don't get it in further far enough down the court, then you're screwed anyway. Yeah, and on that last play, it really seemed like Dirk, because, you know, Rick Carlisle probably wasn't like, oh, hey, if we score, Dirk, you're still going to be in the game. If they go no timeout, what are we going to do? Make sure you guard Steph Curry in a pick and roll. And it was great recognition, of course, from Green and Curry as well. And so Dirk, you know, probably would have been better if he were up further on the three-point line, but Steph had enough time where he could have just driven around him and would have gotten something juicy either way. I mean, there's really, you know, or Dirk could have switched it and that wouldn't have, you know, that would have been better than the ultimate result, but wouldn't have been great either. I mean, what they really probably should have been doing was trapping Steph Curry, but, you know, again, that Dirk is probably even too slow to do that. And, you know, that's why it's tough when you've been in the league for 20 years, I guess.
Yeah, I remember I had some thoughts on some other games because this was a 12-game night. As always, there's just so much going on. And I'm like, oh, we can talk about it if we're running short. And you're like, we never run short. And you were exactly right, because we still have news to get to.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, whenever we can spend 15 minutes discussing 1 minute of actual basketball like we just did, we have to... Take that opportunity. I mean, no, let's do some, like, a lightning round. All right, I'm gonna. You watched more of these other games than I did today, so
Spurs, I'll pick one and talk about it.
Well, here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna set a timer for 90 seconds, and I'll just wind you up, and you can go. So here we go. Let me do this here. And all right, Sixers and Spurs. Here we go.
The Spurs played their B plus squad. Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard weren't out there. Tony Parker wasn't either, and they competed. They were in this game until the end, but Joel Embiid was partially too much, and just overall quality offense from the Sixers. I thought they did a nice job. Overall, Simmons got to the line 15 times, and my favorite moment, yeah, as surprises no one, is Embiid just absolutely stuffing the life out of Joffrey LaVerne regularly, which was just a disaster to begin with.
Yeah, and I didn't see this, but people were tweeting about it, apparently, that the Spurs were in control, and then they started going to hack a Simmons, and Simmons, yep, actually was 10 out of 15 and had 26 points in this one. And LaMarcus, 24 points. But Patty Mills, against his old Australian national team coach, Brett Brown, came up with 26, which I assume is a season high. All right, what else did you watch?
I'll just do some quick hitters. I watched the end of Brooklyn, Minnesota. Dinwiddie got a nice shot. I mean, it got a nice shot on Taj Gibson. They got it on a switch late clock. And then the T-Wolves had a timeout, and they basically ended up with Jimmy Butler hero ball, and he shot at contested two. It kind of seemed like they could have done more with it. Houston, I didn't watch much of this game, but what was most striking to me, they played in Orlando and won easily, was the game was in hand. They were up by 20 with 5 minutes to go, or around 5 minutes to go. Eric Gordon, Chris Paul, and Ryan Anderson were still in the game. CP didn't come out until 3.5 left. And then in Toronto, the short-lived so far, but we're going to have to keep an eye on it, surge in DeMar DeRozan three-pointers. He was 5 of 8 from three in this game, 35 points. He set the franchise record on Monday against the Bucks with 52 points. And then DeLon Wright was crazy. He had a big stretch, 25 points, plus 28 in 30 minutes. And I mean, I don't know how a fan base can hype as many guards as the Raptors fans have, but they deserve it so far.
Yeah, if they can get 9 out of 13 three-point shooting from Wright and DeRozan, that should be good. But yeah, I mean, this will be something to monitor with DeRozan for sure. Also noteworthy that OG Anunoby has fallen off a little bit, has not scored in double figures in quite some time. He was negative 14 in only 16 minutes in this one. Anything else you want to talk about game-wise, or should we hit up some news here?
Well, we can talk briefly. At the very beginning of Detroit-Miami, Boban was killing Hassan Whiteside. Then they switched to Kelly Olynyk, which is the natural counter to Boban, is just play a guy that he can't defend. And Miami had a big clutch stretch, which is something that's going to come up, because I am faithful to the idea of that if I do an award stuff at the beginning of the month, I'm not going to change it. But there's something that happened in that game that made me feel like a gigantic idiot, but I still refuse to change my prediction. So I'm dealing with it.
Yeah, Andre Drummond missing that one with a rib contusion. Stan Van Gundy, always with the nice thing to say about a player, that it's about pain tolerance. No doctor said that he couldn't play. So basically, like, why the hell would you ever say that as a coach? That you're basically, I mean, the guy has like a really bad bad rib contusion. Like, I'm sure most mortal people are not going to be playing with that, but you still just make him sound like a wuss. Like, oh, his pain tolerance is too low to play. Like, just don't say that about your player ever, even if it's true.
So I think where we should start with news is with the Philadelphia 76ers. They are getting closer with Markel Fultz. He is in, I think they called it the final stage of his like recovery. He played a little bit of 4-on-4. The Sixers social media even put out like a highlight reel of his, I think it was New Year's Day. He did a little bit of like kind of practice-y scrimmage stuff. But unfortunately, Furkan Korkmaz is going to be non-weight bearing for at least 3 weeks because of a Lisfranc injury. And so he'll be reevaluated in about 6 weeks. So he's going to be unavailable. Probably, I mean, it's more a Delaware thing than a Sixers thing, but he's going to be unavailable for a while.
Yeah, I mean, with some of their struggles, you might have actually gotten a chance recently with just the lack of shooting that they've had on the wing. But yeah, I mean, those are nasty injuries. I mean, if they're not even talking about him doing rehabilitative basketball training, boy, these are just some mealy-mouthed, say absolutely nothing press releases. The Sixers have actually gone to this policy where Brett Brown now no longer will answer questions about injuries, which, you know, that sounds, other than just like, hey, is this guy playing tonight or not? Which is, I always thought it was kind of weird that the coach has to be the one to give those updates, but the Sixers sure as hell aren't making like the medical staff available, and Brian Colangelo isn't going to talk about that. So it's just press release and here, you know, try to figure out whatever you can from sourcing or anyone else.
Well, actually, there's one other thing I should note on that, because yeah, it was expected that Joel Embiid wasn't going to play in the game against the Spurs, because it was Brett Brown did say something about his injury because he has this hand thing that it was like, I think it was like fireworks going off.
Yeah, he was doubtful.
Yeah, he was doubtful. And so like all the reporters like, oh, he's not going to play. And then he's in the starting lineup. So that's another one of the injury reporting, a different flavor of it, but another thing with the Sixers.
Yeah. And so just from that video, like Fultz's jumper doesn't look quite the same as UW's release, looked a little bit lower in front of his head, but at least like doesn't look completely screwed anymore. So, you know, hopefully we'll get back to seeing him in game action and we can all be reminded of why, you know, we thought he was going to be a consensus number one pick and worthy of that designation. In other 2017 draft injury news, Jonathan Isaac with that troublesome ankle, he has just been kind of taken out of circulation at this point. They placed him in an injury rehab and conditioning program. I'm not sure what he was doing when he was out before and how that's supposed to be different, but whatever it is, I think they, you know, with the Magic going nowhere this season, they want to say, hey, you know what, he re-sprained his ankle, let's just make sure he's like absolutely 100%, let's make sure he's in great shape, maybe he'll even play, you know, a little rehab in the G League or something like that. In Indiana, Victor Oladipo, as they got crushed by the Bucks tonight by 21 points and have been completely non-competitive without him, he has missed the last four with the designation has been nothing more than sore right knee, but he continues to be ruled out pretty far ahead of these games. And so you wonder, you know, sore right knee, you don't know what's causing that. Is it tendonitis? Is it swelling? Is it, you know, you don't really know what it is. You think there's probably something underlying, but apparently they're like the worst team in the league without him. So they better get him back soon.
Going back to the 2017 draft class, De'Aaron Fox returned. There was a little bit of concern because there was a moment in that game after he had a quad tear that he looked off, but he did stay in the game. So that's nice. And, you know, I was going to say something about how the Kings need him, but A, he's a young rookie point guard, and B, they're awful either way. So it's good to see him back, though, because he is a big part of their future and they need to know exactly what they have in him.
Yeah. And in OKC, Andre Robertson will miss all three games of this road trip, which started in outstanding fashion as they destroyed the Lakers by 37 tonight. Alex Abrines, who has had pretty much a lost season to date, out with a groin injury. So that meant that Terrence Ferguson started, and he had 24 points, 9 of 12 from the field, 6 of 9 from 3, and 3 steals tonight. So that's encouraging. You know, he's not going to get to play the Lakers, who are really kind of in a tailspin now, 1-11 in their last 12 games. And it seems like just the wheels are starting to come off there to some degree. They did get Brook Lopez back in this one. He came off the bench 16 minutes. And then Lonzo, who amazingly, despite the fact that he had shot so poorly this year, it does seem that they have quite missed. He is hoping to return on Friday. And one more thing here is one of our favorites is going to be in maybe the best place that you can be to develop in the G League.
Yeah, a machination that you wouldn't be surprised to see the Miami Heat pull off, where they signed Derrick Jones Jr. to a two-way contract. He had been on a full NBA contract with the Suns. They let him go, and then they brought him to the Northern Arizona Suns, and then basically Miami signed him away. But how they had to do that was they had Matt Williams Jr. on a two-way contract. They let him off his two-way contract, re-brought him into the Skyforce, and now Derrick Jones Jr. is on it, and Miami has done a wonderful job of developing players, and one of their specific strengths is helping guys who are athletically gifted develop a more complete game. And for me, Tyler Johnson is the poster child of this. Like, he just got so much better when he was in Sioux Falls, and now he's translated that into a nice NBA contract and, you know, a big part of their success so far this year. So not saying that's necessarily going to happen with Derrick Jones, but they will take the time to develop him as long as they can have him.
Yeah, and with Justice Winslow now having been out since December 13th with his left knee, is yet to return to practice. Rodney Magruder, another product, of course, of that Sioux Falls system, has been out all year with that stress fracture. So Jones actually might play a little bit, and Deion Waiters has been out as well for a few weeks with his ankle. So they do need some bodies on the wing. So this is a nice combination. Maybe he can help. Oh, Carl White's out too. So maybe he can help them a little bit for the time being. Probably not, but he at least plays the right position and is so incredibly athletic that, you know, the Heat really help players improve their bodies as well. That's something that he needs to do from a strength standpoint. And hopefully eventually he can be, you know, a really athletic small ball four type of guy, even if his shot doesn't necessarily come around. He's got these great gifts. He's got to play harder. And, you know, the Heat, Sioux Falls, they're going to teach him how to do that there, if anyone can. So when is your next Danny story time coming out?
Probably tomorrow at some point. We're recording our awards pod, and I've been working on a Bulls piece, which will hopefully go to The Athletic at some point. So I think I'll do it tomorrow during the day after I get those things done.
All right. Yeah. Well, we also have to record our awards pod tomorrow. That will be how we end the week. And don't forget about the Twitter NBA show. Thunder Clippers is the nightcap, but the big game, Warriors at Houston. We will talk to y'all tomorrow. Till then.